argument. Before you begin, I'll make a couple of comments. First of all, you have your choice between what podium to stand in front of. If you choose to stand the one in the middle, that does adjust, so you can take a second to raise it or lower it. In addition, I'm sure you both are aware our special rules allow you for 15 minutes in each of your principal arguments with a 5-minute rebuttal for the appellant. And when you do begin, if you would please state your name, pronounce it for us, as well as that of that as your client, and let us know how you'd like us to refer to you and your client during your argument this morning. And we will start with, is it Vaccaro?
It's Vaccaro.
Vaccaro. Are you ready to proceed, sir?
If I may have just one moment, I'd like to bring something up on my tablet here. Thought I had it open.
You can take a minute. Don't worry about it, and make sure you have all the notes you need before proceeding.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning. May it please the court, Joseph G. Vaccaro, attorney for appellant James R. Pavelka, Jr. You may call me Mr. Vaccaro and my client, Mr. Pavelka. This case presents a rather straightforward question of whether or not of the statute of frauds. And that is to say, the idea that for centuries we have always, because of the need to maintain an orderly system of titling property, treated a written document evidencing an agreement to change interests in property as the final word on that matter. And that we've required a written agreement because property interests are the sort of things people engage in litigation about constantly. And in this particular case, the district court erred in not applying the statute of frauds to this transaction. And that's because in 2003, a writing was prepared that demonstrated the agreement between these two parties as to what was going to happen to this house. Ms. Shadursky was going to transfer her interest in the property to Mr. Pavelka. It's plain as day on that quitclaim deed. And the district...
Mr. Vaccaro, does the quitclaim deed say anything about the future transfer of property? In other words, let's say it wasn't a quitclaim deed. Let's say I bought a house in 2017 and I sold it today. Is there anything about the 2017 transfer of property that would implicate or affect my right to transfer it again 5 years later?
It would not affect your right to transfer it again. You would need to make a writing evidencing that transfer to survive the statute of frauds, or pursuant to the Snow case, if you were to rely on some sort of doctrine of promissory estoppel, you would need to make two showings, one of which Ms. Shadursky can't make. You need to show that you entered the property upon reliance. And that requirement is very important, that a person enter the property upon
reliance.
Let's not
go to that piece yet. I still want to kind of disentangle the arguments here. You're making an argument that there was some parole evidence, that the purported oral promise was parole evidence, and therefore that was a problem. You're also making the argument that the statute of frauds bars any future oral promise or contract that would be different from what was in the quitclaim deed.
I'm specifically saying that it would under the facts of this case. And that is because of the holding in the Snow case, that a party needs to both enter upon reliance and make improvements upon reliance. When we think about oral agreements regarding interest in property, we need to remember that Minnesota recognizes oral leases, and that in Minnesota today, there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people who reside in a property paying a portion of the mortgage, as Ms. Shadursky did, pursuant to an oral agreement. If the district court's holding is upheld, those people are free then to simply argue the agreement was not a lease, rather, but that I would maintain an interest in the home and that my payment of rent takes my agreement outside of the statute of frauds, and I can therefore attack my landlord's title.
Mr. Vaccaro, in your brief, you do say that you're not challenging the factual findings in the district court, but there are portions of your argument, as you just stated, that seem to draw a factual dispute about what was promised. So let me be very clear. I'm assuming that you're not challenging the factual findings because the brief doesn't specifically assert error in that regard. You didn't make a motion for new findings, new trial, amended findings. So I'm assuming that you are conceding today at oral argument that we're not looking at whether the finding of what was said from Mr. Pavelka is clearly erroneous, right?
My contention is that what was said by Mr. Pavelka is not definite enough to invite reliance, and that even if it was, as a legal matter, the first prong of Snow isn't satisfied. Ms. Shedersky entered this property as an owner. In 2003, she transferred title to Mr. Pavelka, making him the sole owner, never leaving the property. She didn't leave after the title transfer in 2003, only to be enticed back by a promise by Mr. Pavelka that she would then somehow regain a half ownership in the home. So no, I don't quarrel with the facts of the case. I merely quarrel with the application of the law.
The district court found that Mr. Pavelka made a promise that she would be a 50% owner as long as she paid half the mortgage. And it seemed like there were portions of your brief that disputed that finding. And so I want to make sure today we're clear because, again, we are going to defer to credibility determinations of the district court.
I understand.
Make a motion for new findings. You don't clearly assert error in that finding. So asking us to review that finding for clear error or not?
No, I'm not asking you to review that finding for clear error. My assertion is quite simply that the Snow case lays out a test. And the test says whether or not you can take an agreement outside of the statute of frauds. Whether when you agree to transfer an interest in title to property and don't make a written record of it, what does the person asserting that that agreement existed need to show? And the Snow test says that they have to show two things, that even if a promise is made, that they have to show entrance upon reliance and improvement upon reliance. They have to show both. And in this case,
can't we in Snow say, okay, those were the facts in that case with regard to you have to enter? I mean, why can't we say she was already there? I mean, and so we have a different set of facts, but otherwise we can apply Snow.
Well, I would say that the Snow does, I mean, Snow's precedent, it's binding. It says that it lays out a test and, you know, then
it doesn't say only, does it, though?
I believe it, may I consult my notes? I believe it does.
I don't think it deals with that issue specifically because those weren't the facts in that case. I mean, these are the criteria. Anyway, okay, go ahead.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Let me ask it this way. What is driving the decision in Snow such that we would say that it's a distinction with a difference, whether you refuse to leave or choose not to leave versus entering for the first time? What is it about the logic or the reasoning in Snow that would make us agree that there's this distinction so that it's inapplicable to someone who is not leaving as opposed to entering?
Certainly, and the reason that you would make that distinction is that because for 15 years to the world, that property was titled entirely in Mr. Pavelka's name. She never left. She is not out anything. She stayed in the property. The purpose of promissory estoppel is that a person has relied to their detriment on a promise that it is reasonable to rely upon. And the U.S. Bank case says that it is, as a matter of law, it is unreasonable to rely upon a promise that is contradicted by a written agreement. The essence of Snow was that Snow didn't enter. Snow didn't make improvements. He said that they just promised me this land. And the court said, well, you haven't done anything. You've not relied to your detriment. In this case here, we have
pay half the mortgage every month?
No, he did not, but every tenant pays a portion of their landlord's mortgages. That's why when the eviction moratorium was in place, landlords were all over the news announcing that they could not pay their mortgages because their tenants weren't paying rent. The question of whether a payment...
One of the things the judge looked at was that Ms. Shadursky paid for part of this bathroom remodel. I mean, that was over $2,000, wasn't it, in the record? And that's not typical tenant behavior.
It's certainly not typical tenant behavior, but it's also not tenant behavior that merits an awarding of half the property.
Now you're arguing the facts again and the findings of fact.
I don't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. Finish. I'm not. Question in there. So finish.
So my view of the facts of the case is that we don't dispute that she paid for the bathroom. The question then is, as a matter of law, is that the sort of behavior that a tenant would engage in that would then merit an award of half the home? So I'm not quarreling with the fact that she paid for half the bathroom. But if we entered into a contract where I would pay for half of a bathroom improvement on your house, no court would say that I am now awarded half of Judge Siegel's home. They would say that, Judge Siegel, if you refuse to pay me, I'm owed for half the cost of the improvement of your bathroom, but I'm not owed an equitable title in your property.
Right, but the judge did find that your client said that Ms. Shadursky would be a 50% owner. I mean, that's a credibility finding. I believe her testimony.
And so
help me understand why we should rule differently on that.
Certainly, because as the U.S. Bank case says, as a matter of law, if you sign a contract that you just sold me your car, and I said, well, actually, you own half the car, it would be unreasonable to think that you still retain an ownership in the car because you've just signed a contract. You've signed under oath that you're signing away your interest in the car to me, and you've put that on file with the county, and everybody in the world is now invited to rely upon that representation.
But applying the facts of this case, it would be, yes, I am signing over my half of the car to you today. And then 3 weeks later, I was like, no, I don't really want to sell it. And you tell me, okay, well, if you take over half of all the payments, pay maintenance, you know, car repairs, auto body, whatever, I don't want to eat up your time here. That's a new representation. I mean, that's a later in time promise.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I understand what you're saying, but I also think that would not be reasonable for you to rely on, because everybody would know that if you went down and tried to the DMV and attempted to purchase tabs for that car, they would say, well, no, that car's now titled in Joe's name. If that car got into an accident and I was sued as the owner of that car, you would not be jumping up and down in order to
So reasonable reliance. You're saying the court got it wrong and saying this was reasonable reliance when they're living together, involved in a decades-long romantic relationship.
Yes,
she should not have relied.
I believe the case.
On what the person told her who she was romantically involved with and living with. I mean, is that, and so where do we get, I mean, is there any case law?
The U.S. Bank case, and I think that this is necessary to uphold written contracts and to avoid all of these messy equitable remedies that arise and we attempt to prevent with written contracts, where we say with someone, when you have a written agreement as to one thing, it's unreasonable to rely on it it's unreasonable to rely on an oral representation to the contrary.
Counsel, I feel like we're talking about this in a vacuum. They jointly purchased the property, correct?
That's correct.
Now, she has some issues regarding being afraid she may be going bankrupt at some point.
Yes.
And so when it comes time to get the financing, she decides that she shouldn't be on the title because it might screw up the financing arrangement, correct?
Sure.
That's
the
finding.
That's the finding, yes.
Okay. All right, so she executes the quitclaim deed, and the court finds, after that quitclaim deed, that he made the representation that, well, don't worry, half this is yours. Why isn't that reasonable under all these circumstances? It isn't quite like just suggesting that in a vacuum, somehow this person's claiming they got half of it. I don't see any reference to rent until very late in the game here. It looks like there's equity involved from day one.
Well, I would say that I think it's unreasonable because the most reasonable thing to rely on is a deed, and that you would say to the person, if you really want me to have half this house, then you should have no issue deeding the property back to me.
Even though they jointly bought the property, even though she was on the deed prior to the execution of the quitclaim deed.
Yes, because she was simply on notice that as a matter of law, she no longer owned half the home. This is not a situation where the two parties buy a house together and one party says, oh, come on, what's between us doesn't matter. Give me half for the down payment. We don't need to put your name on the title. If Ms. Shadursky wished to have a half interest in the property, she never had to divest herself of it by signing that quitclaim deed.
Well, arguably, she was looking out for the other party as well if she thought that her bankruptcy would screw up the financing.
Well, she never did go bankrupt.
Well, I understand. But the point is, that was what she was in her mind at the time, according to the findings.
Well, yes. Okay. I guess I'll conclude by saying that if this holding and this ruling is allowed to stand, we essentially disrupt our entire orderly system of property. As I made reference to earlier, hundreds of thousands of people reside in property to which they know they don't hold title to in Minnesota. They pay sometimes even more than half the mortgage, sometimes the entire mortgage plus the upkeep the landlord provides. And what we're basically saying here is that there's some great injustice about living in a property to which one knowingly doesn't hold title and paying the mortgage. We open up every landlord's...
And, Council, it seems like you're stretching the facts a bit here to compare it to every tenant in the state, because in this case, we have a finding that there was a promise that as long as she paid half the mortgage, she'd be a co-owner. So the only disruption would be to similarly situated tenants who have a promise that they are 50% owner as long as they're paying the mortgage.
Can I? I mean, I'm out of time. Do you mind if I respond?
Go ahead.
Certainly. But the purpose of the statute of frauds is to avoid unnecessary litigation. And if this situation arises where there's a writing that evidences that property has been transferred from one party to another, and one party is then free to say, there's this promise. That promise is afforded deference up until the moment of trial, even at a motion for summary judgment, that promise will be assumed to be true. We're going to subject people to all sorts of quiet title litigation based on oral representations where that issue was to be put to bed by the deed and by our system of titling property. That's my answer to that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Amber Stavig with the law firm of Dudley & Smith, PA. My client is respondent Ms. Heather Shadursky. You may refer to her as Ms. Shadursky. At its heart, this case is about a couple who purchased, remodeled, refinanced a home together, a home that they lived in for 22 years as a couple. The reason we're standing in front of you today is because the couple broke up and their interests were bifurcated. After years of litigation, the district court made several factual findings at trial, of which the court found that the evidence established that the quitclaim deed was signed into because the parties wanted to protect their joint interests of the property. The court also found credible that Ms. Shadursky relied on the promise made by Mr. Pavelka following the quitclaim deed that so long as she continued to pay half of the mortgage and reside in the property, that the property would be 50% hers. The court also found credible that Mr. Pavelka did in fact make that promise. Further, the court found that enforcement of this promise would be necessary to avoid injustice, as it would strip Ms. Shadursky of all of the equity that she had built in the home over 22 years.
Ms. Stavig, I'm still having a bit of trouble trying to disentangle some of the factual arguments from the legal ones. I tried to ask Mr. Vaccaro specifically whether there was a factual challenge regarding this promise or reliance. And I think he said no. that we're only applying those facts to the law, not disputing the facts. Is that consistent with your view of the argument today, that it is not about the facts of reliance or the facts underlying the finding about promise?
Correct. It's my understanding that as there were no post-trial motions made on the factual findings, that we are here today to only discuss the application of those facts to the law and whether or not that was sufficient enough for the findings of promissory estoppel and declaratory judgment.
And you don't read the brief to assign error regarding a factual finding?
I believe it might have been mentioned, but due to the structure of the way that the brief was mentioned, I didn't think that we were here today to parse out factual findings.
Thank you.
Ms. Shadursky believes that this court should uphold the court's findings that it would be unjust to deprive Ms. Shadursky of 50% ownership interest in the property, where she did, in fact, purchase the property with Mr. Pavelka, which he paid no consideration for when she eventually did sign the quitclaim deed over to him and the property was refinanced. And Mr. Pavelka did promise that she would maintain ownership after signing the quitclaim deed. And that she maintained the residency requirements and the mortgage payment requirements in reliance of that promise, in addition to upkeep that would not be expected of her if she were only a tenant. Appellant is correct that Minnesota law has codified the statute of frauds with regard to real property, but Minnesota law also provides an exception to the statute of frauds where strict reliance on the statute of frauds would result in an injustice to one party. Read together, the statute of frauds and its exception puts forth that the point is not to strictly avoid litigation or read the four corners of one document and disregard all future promises. It's to avoid a technicality from stripping somebody of equity that they put into real property.
Well, how is part performance relevant here, and then if it's relevant, how do you respond to Mr. Vaccaro's argument? Well, she didn't enter. She was already there under snow.
So with regard to the partial performance, that is a requirement of an exception to the statute of frauds with regard to promissory estoppel and real property. They must rely on that promise and partially perform the requirements of them under that promise. Here it was not just a promise, as it was in snow, that you can have this land. It was a promise that you can maintain this 50% ownership, but you have to do this and that. She partially performed by making the mortgage payments and residing in the property. And I'm sorry, could you repeat the second part of your question, please?
Under using snow then, Mr. Vaccaro argued that that because Ms. Shadursky was already living in the property, that part performance doesn't apply here.
So as the district court decided, we believe that Bredesen v. Bredesen is more instructive in this case, as in the Bredesen case, they did already reside in that property. And then, again, it was a difference when there was a bifurcation issue. And again, snow does allow for promissory estoppel. The difference in snow was that he was promised by, I believe it was his late father, that he would have this property when he passed away. There was no writing. And in that, the performance was not enough to give him ownership, because in that instance, they found that he didn't do anything other than what a tenant would do if there were a lease of that property. In this instance, the district court did find that Ms. Shadursky engaged in acts that would not be expected of her if it were simply a lease. They did find that she behaved as though she were an owner of that property. And in addition to that, there was no evidence presented that Mr. Vaccaro ever gave Ms. Shadursky a certificate of rent paid. Ms. Shadursky did present evidence that she paid for taxes, insurance, and there was no evidence presented that Mr. Pavelka ever put the income from Ms. Shadursky's mortgage payments on his tax returns, as a landlord would be expected to do. With that being said, again, this is a fairly straightforward case. I don't have much more other than if we follow the strict four corners of a deed, which typically is prefaced by a purchase agreement, which has a full integration clause stating that any additional oral arguments will not be, in fact, valid. It usually requires that all simultaneous or short time period agreements be put into writing, unlike there was here. If we're allowed to just look at one deed and say that's the entirety of the agreement, and regardless of how much time, money spent at the property, whether you paid the entire mortgage yourself, that you have no property interests, you have no equity interests, that goes against Minnesota law, and that stripping of equity of Ms. Shedersky would be unjust. As such, we believe that this court should uphold the district court's findings.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Vaccaro.
Thank you. Certainly. First, as to the Snow case, I believe Your Honor did ask if it says only. Snow says must, which I think we would agree is the same as the word only, that he must enter in reliance and make improvements upon reliance. My worry here is, as we talk about what is reasonable and what is not reasonable, is that my position would be that the court should adopt that as a rule, it is as a matter of law, unreasonable to knowingly sign your rights to property away and then not attempt to regain those rights with a writing. Because it's unreasonable, you know, in doing that that's what's required to sign your interest in property away, a writing, a deed. And that when you rely, and that writing exists, and that writing is presumed valid until subject to attack, and that the whole world, including the courts, are going to presumptively assume that writing is valid. And if you wish to get your property rights back, at a minimum, you need to make out another writing, and that it is unreasonable to rely on a written promise to the contrary. And I'm not sure whether it's within the realm of this argument or not, but the characterization of the payments as rent or a mortgage seems to me to be a legal question, not a factual question. There's no dispute that the money was paid, but the question is, how do we characterize that money? And my position is that Ms. Shedersky put herself in the position of any tenant after she remained in that house and continued paying money pursuant to that quitclaim deed. She was paying a monthly sum to live in a house to which she knew that she did not hold title. And she didn't hold title to that house because she wished to shield it from bankruptcy. She got consideration for that purchase. And I did state that in my brief, that the court's finding that there was no consideration for this transaction isn't true. She was relieved of a debt obligation. The court found that. The court found that Mr. Pavelka assumed sole responsibility for the mortgage. So I guess I'm not going to chew up anybody's time here more than is necessary, but I do wish to impress upon the court that my reading of the statute of frauds and my reading of Minnesota case law is that it is just simply unprecedented to go back and essentially, by virtue of finding that a subsequent oral representation was made, that it is equitable to restore someone to a property interest that they knowingly signed away. And so I believe that because Ms. Shedersky knowingly gave up a half interest in the home, stayed there paying rent, paying some amount of money, not incommensurate with rent, stayed there, received a place to live in exchange for that, that she is not out anything. She simply put herself in the position of a renter for the past 15 years, and if she wished to maintain an equity on that home, she should have kept title to that home and should have had it subject to attachment by creditors, to the liability, to all the other sort of obligations that Mr. Pavelka took on by making himself the sole title holder, and burdens that she was relieved of by virtue of that transaction. And if there's no more questions, I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Vaccaro.
Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments this morning. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time frame.